Big news. The new Sprint LTE Plus network is faster than Verizon and AT&T, based on analysis of a recent study by Nielsen. And to celebrate, we're inviting you to join Sprint for the biggest offer in U.S. wireless history. Switch to Sprint and save 50% on most Verizon, AT&T, or T-Mobile rates. Yep, you heard that right. No gimmicks, no tricks. You have Verizon 6 gigs for $60, 30 with Sprint. And if you have 15 gigs for $100 from AT&T, 50 with Sprint. Even if you have T-Mobile's 10 gigs for $80, we'll give it to you for $40, and we won't force you to watch video in low def. Oh, and one more thing. Buy or lease the hottest Samsung Galaxy smartphones and get a free 32-inch LED Samsung TV. Don't wait. Offer ends December 24th. Visit a Sprint store or sprint.com/free Samsung TV.
See claim based on Sprint's analysis of average LTE download speeds using Nielsen and MP data. Actual download speeds may vary by location and device capability. Offer coverage not available everywhere or for discounted phones. Excludes taxes, surcharges, roaming, and premium content. Subject to new line $36 activation fee, credit valid for it. Plans may not be exact match. See website for eligible plans. Offer ends 1/7/16, savings to 1/8/18. Exclusions and restrictions apply. TV after online rebate subject to terms.
Log Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me. You call home. Je call home. Je call rien de ça. Je vous écoute.
Hi, this is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in science. Welcome to yet another exciting show. Now, Plato was the snob philosopher, the guy who thought wisdom was to be had only by the intellectual elites. Aristotle's my man, the man who, like cognitive therapy founder Dr. Albert Ellis, believed that wisdom was attainable by ordinary people, and it is. And tonight, a wonderful return guest on Advice Goddess Radio, Dr. Barry Schwartz, will explain how emotions are actually the key to wisdom and how you can actually train yourself to be wise. Yes, I know, this runs contrary to all the conventional thinking that emotions should be kept out of business or professional decisions or decisions of any importance. Dr. Schwartz will lay out why that's not the case and why practical wisdom is a key to both personal and relationship happiness. And that is the title of his terrific book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing, which he co-authored with poli-sci prof Dr. Kenneth Sharp. Hello, Barry.
Hi, Amy. Nice to be back.
I'm so glad to have your show on. The show you did on Choice is just so great. So I know tonight's going to be fantastic. And there's just so much in your book that I really am just so passionate about. Especially about, you know, you started talking about how we have all these rules these days and not a lot of wisdom. And for me, a big deal is these zero tolerance policies in school. A girl brings a Mite All to school and she's expelled. I mean, this is really crazy. And you and your co-author, Kenneth Sharp, observed that we Americans are growing increasingly disenchanted with this stuff, with the institutions in our lives and how they behave this way.
It's true. And You can look at almost in any direction. We make a big deal in the book, not so much about disciplining kids in schools, but about how teachers are given scripts to follow, with scripts in remarkable detail, 70-item script to teach kindergarten kids, a 20-page picture book. And the reason that administrators give teachers scripts is that they don't have confidence that the teachers have enough good judgment to figure out how to teach on their own. And so they figure you design a curriculum that's idiot-proof, that's judgment-proof, that's wisdom-proof, and then you can plug any moron into it and deliver a quality education. So it's ludicrous because, I mean, it's the wrong way to teach. And in addition to being the wrong way to teach, anybody who's got any real talent or passion for teaching isn't going to stay in it if this is what teaching means. So what happens is you prevent wisdom, you prevent teachers from developing good judgment. You get teachers who have good judgment to leave the profession and do something else, or if not that, you basically beat the good judgment out of them. And you see this in every aspect of education, not just in the silly discipline rules that people don't have the sense to know when to make exceptions to.
Right. I dealt with this myself. I read very fast, and I was not allowed to finish, quote unquote, finish reading the book until everybody else had finished. It was supposed to take you half an hour, and it took me 10 minutes. And those were the rules. And it's really damaging for the kids as well as the teachers.
It's damaging for everybody. The weird thing is that for parents in your audience, every parent knows that rules are fine, but you have to be prepared to make exceptions to all of them. You know, you want to treat your kids fairly. That certainly does not mean treating your kids alike. In fact, parents who treat their kids exactly alike are almost certainly bad parents, because different kids need different things, and they need different things at different times. And if you really know your child in a nuanced way, if you can get inside your child's head, if you can feel the sorts of emotions that your child is feeling, you'll tailor your child rearing to each individual child. And an ideal school teacher does the same thing. And this, by the way, is true not just when you're teaching little kids. It's true when you're teaching college students. Different students need different things. Some need a kick in the ass. Some need a little bit of encouragement. And if you don't know them, you have no alternative but to basically do one size fits all. And, of course, one size doesn't fit all. One size basically fits nobody.
And you say, as the title of your book goes, that the answer to the thing that would improve how these institutions are run, how our lives are run, is practical wisdom. And can you define what that is?
Well, we took the term from Aristotle. The Greek word for it is phronesis. And as you said in your intro, Aristotle was not interested in the kind of abstract wisdom that Plato was interested in, you know, the wisdom of mathematics and highly sophisticated philosophy, where you imagine old men, typically men, with long white beards sitting on top of mountains and telling you what the nature of the world is. He had in mind the kind of wisdom that ordinary people show in their everyday interactions with the material world and with one another. And it was practical. It was not theoretical. And it was acquired by experience. The way you became wise was by trying and failing, picking yourself up, dusting yourself off, trying again. Or you learned by watching a master, being mentored by a master who had already made those kinds of mistakes and could spare you making some of them. And very importantly for Aristotle was what some people have called the priority of the particular, meaning that each situation demands a response that is appropriate to that situation, that context, those people. And rules, formulas, abstract principles won't get you what you actually need in the concrete situation. The way we sometimes talk about it, Ken and I, is that rules are like a roadmap that gets you to the right city but doesn't have any of the streets marked. You'll never get to the street you want without getting to the right city. So it's nice to have a map that gets you to the right city. But getting to the right city isn't enough if you need to find a particular street. And it's judgment, it's wisdom that enables you to find the right street.
And so I just want to emphasize that you aren't anti-rules, but it's just that you say that there's something more that's needed.
More, and sometimes you have to break the rules. You know, what is this cliche? There's an exception to every rule. There is. And wise people know when to make the exceptions. They won't get it right. We won't get it right all the time. Sometimes we'll think this requires an exception, and you know, we'll be wrong. It doesn't require an exception. But there are worse things in life than being wrong. And the notion that following rules prevents you from ever being wrong is just folly.
And now you write that acting wisely calls for being guided by the correct aims and goals of a particular activity, and Aristotle called this telos. So can you tell me about that and give us an example?
Sure. So, you know, we put an enormous amount of confidence and faith in the desire of people to do the right thing. In fact, instead of really defining wisdom, what we say is wisdom is knowing the right thing, doing the right thing in the right way at the right time for the right reason. Now, that doesn't actually tell you very much. You have a kid who's acting out in fourth grade. What's the right thing to do? What's the right way to do it? What's the right reason for doing it? That's what experience teaches you. But the critical presupposition here is that teachers want to do the right thing. That is to say, they are not there to get a paycheck. They are not there to get health and dental and prescription drug coverage. They are not there to get a good pension. They are there to inspire and educate young people. That's their goal, and that is the goal. Telos is just a Greek word for goal. The goal of education is to inspire and illuminate young minds, and the presumption is that people who enter teaching want to do that. And people who enter medicine want to be able to cure disease and ease suffering. And people who enter the law want to be able to help people solve problems and serve justice. And then the question is, how do you actually go about doing these things? And I think as a society, we've become completely cynical. And we have the attitude that everyone's just in it for the money. Nobody cares. Everyone would mail it in unless you were standing over them. And making sure that they couldn't just mail it in. And I think this is just a completely erroneous view of what gets people out of bed in the morning.
You actually say this thing I found very interesting, that our confidence in banks depends on our trust in bankers, and that we wouldn't fault bankers for being quote-unquote greedy if we thought the only point of banking was to make money.
Right. I mean, what does it even mean to say that the banker's greedy? If the objective, and you see this in the financial pages every day, right? If the objective of a company, it doesn't have to be a bank, is to make as much money as possible, if that's your goal, then what does it mean to be greedy? You can't ever make too much. So greedy simply defines success. That's what you're there for. That's not what we typically think bankers are for, or at least it isn't what we used to think bankers were for. They were model citizens in communities. They held communities together. They're the reasons that businesses got started. They're the reasons that houses got bought or houses got remodeled or savings got put away for kids' college educations. They were really, you know, beacons and looked up to by members of the community because their job was to make a living, but to make a living by serving a community and serving a community in a particular way. Nobody thinks that that's what bankers are for now. And if anyone did think that that's what bankers were for, you could only conclude that they've been asleep for the last decade.
Well, I just want to say, I think it's really important to reward people, bankers who do behave that way. I had Bank of America let my money be stolen by these women with no ID, no bank card, no PIN, fake driver's license. And I started banking at this teeny bank, you know, and I get the sense that I matter and matter a lot. And so these people are behaving the way you talk about in the book. They're practically wise. They do things that, like this woman called me. I deposited a check, and it was from Canada, and she said they're going to charge you a $25 fee. She called me at home. It wasn't like some form letter I got. And those things, they matter. And I think if people reach out to people who behave well, who aren't the people, as you say in the book, that are just operating on rules or incentives, but who are operating on something else, that encourages that.
It does. And, you know, your experience is not only not unique, it's not even unusual. When something like this happens to us, it just makes our day. The idea that we're actually dealing with someone who seems to be interested in our welfare is just inspiring because it seems like such a rare event, somebody who goes out of their way to help you or goes the extra mile, you know. We also bank, my wife and I. It's a huge bank, but they have managed to communicate this ethos of customer and client service, and I can't tell you how many times my local banker has – You know, it taken an initiative to make me aware of something that he thought would serve my interests. Now, no doubt he gets rewarded for that. You know, I say nice things about him. Maybe he gets promoted, but he manages at least to convey to me the sense that he's doing it because he takes seriously his responsibilities as a banker.
Yeah, I think it's really wonderful that as customers we have a responsibility to really thank those people so they keep doing it.
Let their supervisors know, too.
Right, and I actually went in. I tried to comment on my bank's website. It wouldn't let me, so I actually walked into the bank and told this woman, Monica, who's the manager, how nice they were, how much it meant to me, because I know how much it means to me when somebody tells me that they appreciate my advice. And so, you know, I know that that's a common human emotion. And I should just break out and do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. Tonight's brain belongs to Dr. Barry Schwartz, co-author of a much-needed book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. It does something I love, desnobifying wisdom and laying out what it takes for ordinary people to act with wisdom in their jobs, personal lives, and relationships. Now, I want to get into what wisdom is, and you, my favorite story in the book, and you have a lot of great stories, is this story about the custodian in the hospital. He's in a big teaching hospital. Can you tell that great story?
Yes, this really grabs people, I must say. A colleague of mine who now teaches at Yale did some research on what she called dirty work. She was interested in the way in which people who, for most of us, are invisible, think about their jobs. And one of her studies was of hospital janitors at a high-powered teaching hospital in the Midwest. Now, I'm sure you appreciate, and most of your listeners do too, that these people are essentially invisible to us as patients or as the loved ones of patients. They have no status. Somehow or other, everything is clean. We pay no attention to how that happens. And we assume they're just interchangeable parts. And that it takes about 5 minutes to learn how to do their job. And what Amy found, this psychologist at Yale, is that a significant minority of hospital janitors did not behave that way and didn't think that their job was simple. And she describes examples of somebody who starts to wash the floor in the hallway, and then some old guy who's recovering from surgery comes out into the hall, committed to walking up and down the hall to get a little bit of exercise and strengthen himself. So the janitor stops washing the floor. Now, his job is to wash the floor. That's one of the 40 things on his that make up his job description. But he thinks his job is to aid in whatever way he can in the care and comfort of patients. And what's needed here from this janitor at this moment is that he cease and desist washing the floor so that the guy can walk up and down and not slip and break his neck. There's another example of somebody who's cleaning a visitor's lounge, and there'd been a family basically camped out there 24/7 because somebody must have been desperately ill, and she noticed that they were taking a nap in the lounge, so she didn't clean the lounge. And she says to her interviewer, you know, I may pay for this. My manager may come down on me, but, you know, I'm going to do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. And the final example I'll give you is of a guy named Luke who cleaned a patient's room twice because the patient was in a coma, and the patient's father had left to have a cigarette and hadn't seen Luke do it the first time and thought that Luke was just blowing it off because the patient was unconscious. So the father was indignant, and Luke, instead of getting angry back or defending himself, said, okay, I'll clean it, and then he cleaned it again with the father watching. So he cleaned the room twice just to make this boy's father feel like he was actually doing something that affected the care of his son. And janitors like this think it takes a lot of experience to learn how to do the job, because for them the job involves interacting with patients and with patients' families, even though there's not a word in their job description that mentions other human beings. So it's really quite you read stories like this, and all of a sudden nobody is invisible anymore. You really pay attention to these people who you've been ignoring for your whole life, and you realize what an essential role they play in the effective running of big and important institutions.
And you talked about how the telos, the aims of the hospital, which are relieving suffering, need to be embodied in the institution, and that those who work there should be encouraged to make it their aim too. So they're not just janitors, they're people who are actually taking care of the patients when needed.
Exactly so. That's what, as I say, that's what gets them out of bed in the morning. They have to feel like they have the authority to be partners in patient care, instead of merely being people who empty trash and clean floors. And you know what's so interesting is that research has been done of medical training, and medical students are at their most empathetic the day before they start doing clinical rounds. From that point on, it's all downhill. So, you know.
Why?
Because it's beaten out of them, basically. The way, you know, the models that they're attending physicians and senior residents present to them are all very matter of fact and know your technical stuff and don't look like a fool when you get grilled on rounds and stuff like that. And they don't even talk about, they don't mention patients by name. They talk about them as the, you know, the failing liver in room 302. So it's they dehumanize the patients left and right, and then they, you know, the students go to a lecture that says you have to treat your patients like people. But meanwhile, they're watching the people training them treating their patients like slabs of meat. And to be fair, you don't want to be so wrapped up in the pain and suffering of your patients that it clouds your judgment, because you often have difficult decisions to make. You often don't have a lot of time to make them. And if you're so completely overcome with emotion at the suffering of a patient or of the patient's family, it might actually interfere with your being able to think clearly. And I guess the presumption is that medical students come in just gushing all of this emotion. So part of your job is to get them to dial it down. And unfortunately, the training is extremely good at getting medical students to dial it all the way down.
It sounds like it. And you write about the need to balance empathy with detachment, but there has to be the empathy there too. You know, and you write about how empathy has a dark side. You can get all eaten up, like you're saying. But you tell this story, you know, actually of a doctor who did sort of get eaten up by his liking for the patient, who didn't want to turn his favorite patient over, and the patient suffered from the doctor sparing him this ordeal.
Yes, and this is a very well-known doctor. It's a guy named Jerome Groopman, who writes frequently in The New Yorker about medical topics. And he wrote a book about how doctors think, and he described this experience of his own when there was this young guy who had developed a rare cancer, I think, in the knee, and it looked like the only option was amputation, but he was extremely physically active, so they tried a course of treatment with an experimental drug that had extremely severe side effects. So the guy was really feeling terrible. And Groopman would come in to see him every day, and he was so in such discomfort that Groopman tried to spare him any additional discomfort so he didn't turn him over. And all of a sudden, the guy spiked a huge fever, and he nearly died. And it turned out he had an abscess in his bottom, and the reason he had developed the abscess is that he hadn't been turned. And the reason he hadn't been turned is that Groopman wanted to spare him the discomfort of having to move his body. So, yes, too much empathy can lead you to make big mistakes, but so can too little empathy.
And
particularly
you
when
we...
you're,
oh, let sorry,
me just say,
go ahead.
This is especially true if you see your job not just as curing disease, but as enabling patients to manage diseases. Most in the developed world, most disease. The medical problem that we face in the U.S. and other developed societies is managing chronic disease. We have basically beaten acute disease, not completely, but to a large extent. So going forward, the question will be, how do you manage cardiac insufficiencies? How do you manage diabetes? How do you manage chronic back pain and other kinds of pain and so on? And in every one of these examples, the way you manage is by making the patient a partner. You enlist the patient as a partner, because unless people change the way they live, there's no magic bullet that's going to fix these problems. And you don't get patients to change the way they live by being a sort of cold, mechanical doc handing down expertise from the mountaintop and expecting patients to follow it. You have to convince the patient that you and the patient are on the same side, that you're fighting this fight together, and encourage patients to do the hard things it takes to change the way they live their lives. So it's bad medicine to be a sort of technically perfect machine in interacting with patients.
Yeah, and I don't think that we realize that enough. And you write about, just going back to the janitor, that his response took a balancing act, and this is what wisdom takes, that he had to balance he had his own anger, all these things going on, and that this took some deliberative skills, you know, and framing. Can you explain that?
Well, it takes deliberative skills because on the one hand, the janitor was being, you know, mistreated and rudely treated by the patient, and he felt that justice demanded, in some sense, that he state his case and make clear that he had behaved responsibly. On the other hand, compassion demanded, at least of this particular janitor, that he put himself in the shoes of this angry father and ask, what can I do to calm him down, make him feel better? And, you know, how big a deal is it for me to do something that I've already done? So, you can imagine circumstances where cleaning the room again is not the right thing to do. If this guy had consistently been abusive and disrespectful to the janitor, then maybe the right thing to do would have been to stand up and tell the guy that this is not the way you treat another human being. But in this instance, the balance of these two competing aims led him to decide that it was more important to help the father through this difficult time than it was to preserve his own pride and self-respect. And this notion of framing is important because if he framed the situation as a matter of individual rights, justice, and fairness, then he probably would simply have said, listen, I cleaned it. Stop treating me this way. But instead, he framed it as a matter of care and compassion. And that leads to a completely different approach to what the right response is.
And you say that figuring this out requires what you call moral perception and that empathy is a big part of this.
I think empathy is absolutely essential. You can't figure out what other people need. If your aim is to provide what other people need, you have to figure out what they need. And you can't figure out what they need unless you can somehow get inside their skins and imagine what the world looks like to them, what their conflicts are, what their suffering is, and that requires empathy. And I think that people have a natural tendency to empathize with other people who are suffering, especially people who are like them. But it needs to be cultivated, and it needs to be encouraged, not discouraged. And as you pointed out in your intro, we have so long had the view that emotion is the enemy of reason, that we think anything that demands clear thinking, you want to shut the emotional system down. And that, I think, is a huge mistake. I don't know if you remember this, but when Sonia Sotomayor was nominated to be a Supreme Court justice, her opponents made a big deal of a speech that she had given where she talked about how important it was for the people who came before a judge to have a sense that the judge was like them. And she's a Latina, and what she was talking about is that it was important to have Latinas and other non-whites on the bench because they were more likely to be able to adopt the perspective of the people whose lives they were passing judgment on. And she was just ripped apart for having said this. What is there, a Latino justice and a white justice? Blah, 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 blah. And the pity is that instead of insisting, I said it and I meant it and I'm right, she backed away from it. And I think she was exactly right. It's really quite important to have the people who pass judgment on us be not a collection of, you know, white, upper middle class, Ivy League educated lawyers who have absolutely no understanding of what life is like for the rest of society.
I want to do a little station ID. We'll be right back. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Tonight's brain belongs to Dr. Barry Schwartz, a wonderful return guest, co-author of a much-needed book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. It desnobifies wisdom, lays out what it takes for ordinary people to act with wisdom in jobs, personal lives, and relationships, which I think is really important. Now, how can we be judicious about what emotions to let guide us? Because we have a whole stew of them. In a situation that we're confronted with, how do we behave in a way where our emotions make us wise?
Well, again, I think Aristotle provides a nice first touchstone. Aristotle famously talked about the importance of finding the mean. And by mean, the mean has become a technical term. It's the arithmetic average. Mean IQ in a population is 100. That means the average IQ is 100. And Aristotle thought that virtue required finding the mean. You could be courage was the mean between cowardice and recklessness. So it wasn't true that the more courageous you were, the better. A point was reached where your so-called courage endangered your life and the lives of other people, and it was simply foolish. Generosity is the mean between being cheap and being a spendthrift, and finding the mean. But since the mean is not the arithmetic average, what it is, in Aristotle's thinking, is the right amount for this circumstance. So it always takes judgment to find the mean, and that's why practical wisdom was for him the master virtue, because it's wisdom that enables you to find the mean. And I think having to balance between empathy and detachment is another example where you need to find the mean. Sometimes it's appropriate to be angry. Sometimes it's appropriate to be extremely angry, but it's not always appropriate to be extremely angry, and a wise person knows how much anger a given situation calls for. But there's no formula for it. So you're right. Emotions can be extremely destructive to you and to other people, but a life lived without emotion is unimaginable.
Yeah, and actually I find in my own, my book is I See Rude People, One Woman's Battle to Beat Some Manners into Impolite Society, and I will do things and say things that other people wouldn't, but I'm driven by passion. But I also talk to people who are dumping trash in my neighborhood, dumping out a barbecue, all this huge pile of ash across the street in the garden area. I called to them, I yelled to them, but I did look first before I went out of my gate to see if they looked like they were armed. Because if I'm dead, that's not useful. So there is that balancing act. You learn it.
And there's a story in our book, I can't remember now the guy who wrote it, a very hugely best-selling sort of management guru.
Oh,
I think
Stephen Covey.
Stephen
I
Covey,
love this
right.
Story. Oh, my God, that's my second favorite after Luke in the Hospital.
The seven,
about the guy in the train.
Yeah. So he wrote this book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. He's hugely, he's sold, a trillion books. And he describes his experience he had on a train when this dad is just letting his kids run wild on the subway. And the kids are, young kids, and they're just disturbing everybody. And he gets all angry, and he says something. And the father, looking sort of spaced out, matter-of-factly tells him that they're on their way home from the hospital where his wife and these kids' mother has just died. And all of a sudden, it's like a switch got thrown, and Covey reinterpreted everything that had happened to him in the last 10 minutes in a completely different way. So sometimes, however rude the behavior may be, if you know somebody well enough, you can understand it, frame it in a different way, empathize even with it, and respond to it quite differently. The trouble is you need to know people very well before you can make these kinds of nuanced judgments about them. The same thing is true with doctors. Do you tell the patient the truth straight out, or do you find a way to soften the truth if the news you have to give is bad? Well, the right answer to that is it depends on who you're talking to. And doctors tend not to know their patients well enough anymore because of the way medical practice has evolved to be able to make those judgments.
Yeah, it's very important. You write about that here, whether a doctor should, tell this, this man how he was, and the woman played along with her mother, who insisted that her late husband wasn't actually dead. And, some people, we're taught, you must tell the truth. And you talk about these rules of thumb. Tell the truth all the time. Honesty is the best policy, and how those are useful in some ways, but then in others, they really kill our compassion and our ability to act compassionately.
And we know that. We tell them, I don't know if this example is in the book, but we use it in the class that we teach. You stop in to see a friend who's getting ready to go out to this big formal occasion, a young woman, and she lets you in, and she's all dressed up, and she does a little pirouette, and she says, "How do I look?" And actually what you think is not so good. But and the question is, what do you say? So when we present this to our students, our 20-year-old idealists who think that friendship, all close relationships have to be based on complete honesty, they say, well, you just tell her the truth. And then we try to make them think about this in a little bit more nuanced way, you know, like suppose she doesn't really have an alternative, or suppose that she thinks she looks great, and when you tell her she doesn't, it's going to kill her sense that she is a judge of how good or bad she looks, and this is going to undermine her self-confidence going forward. Don't these sorts of considerations matter? And they finally reluctantly acknowledge that sometimes honesty isn't the best policy. But the critical thing, of course, is that if it takes you 10 minutes to answer the question, how do I look, you've answered it long before you open your mouth.
So yeah, absolutely.
You need somehow to come up with the right answer to what do I do instantly, which is possible only if you have a lot of experience in situations like this and a real intimate knowledge of the person you're dealing with. And parents tend to be in that position with their kids, and lovers tend to be in that position with one another, and really close friends tend to be in that position. But you can't have a million really close friends. I don't think Facebook friends are in that position.
No, and people can be really terrible to each other on Facebook. Somebody was just terrible the other day, and I let him have it. Whereas, you know, I don't post stuff. I read people's Facebook pages because all these people follow me because of my newspaper column, and they're politically totally opposed to what I think. I'm not going to comment on that. It's not right. I'm not going to change their mind. It's that thing of realizing where reality is versus where your ego wants to be.
Hmm.
And I think that's very important.
It is very important. But, you know, with an enormous amount of pressure put on people in every domain to be as efficient as possible, this is the god of the economists, efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. What that means is that the time that it takes really to get to know the people you deal with, whether clients of a lawyer, students of a teacher, patients of a doctor, all that time spent just chit-chatting is inefficient use of your time. So that has gone by the wayside, and now you have doctors seeing patients for 8 minutes, and you don't get to know people that way.
No, and in fact, when my friend Kathy Seip was in Cedars-Sinai, and she was very ill with lung cancer, the people who were the compassionate ones who really took care of her beyond the here's this pill were the nurses. They were the people who eased her suffering. It was so important. I have this great respect for nurses because of it, seeing that.
Oh, I have a very close friend who had a mishap as a consequence of routine surgery and nearly died. This just happened a few weeks ago, and
wow.
It was just awe-inspiring to watch the nurses who made all the difference in the world. And one untoward casual comment by a nurse can just completely transform your outlook as a patient or as a patient's loved one. And I think the nurses, by and large, appreciate that and are just incredibly deft at finding the right way to say what needs to be said, anticipate what's needed, what the patient needs to be reassured and also be kept comfortable. And they're what hold hospitals together.
And actually, as I said about my bank, this is something else I do. I think it's so important to recognize people who do good things, and I assume that most nurses, like you said, they're not in it for the money. You know, that when someone tells me they're a nurse, I tell them that story about my friend Kathy and how wonderful and how what a soft spot I have for nurses, because I think that it's important to make them feel good about what is a very tough job.
Absolutely, as Ken and I recently discovered, and I'm embarrassed that this made no appearance in our book, we weren't smart enough to appreciate it, is that the sort of representative of institutions that we have most contact with as ordinary citizens are probably the police. We see them all the time. They're the difference between order and chaos. Safety and fear. They're unbelievably important. And you can't be good at that job either unless you're wise, unless you understand that your aim is to protect and serve, unless you use your discretion as to when to, you know, absolutely follow the letter of the law and when to make exceptions. And none of this is part of police training, we're finding out. And the more pressure gets applied by superiors to make numbers, to make a certain number of arrests, the less likely it is that police will be judicious and wise in their interactions with the public. And the police probably have more to do than anything else with whether we respect our governmental institutions or are contemptuous of them and afraid of them.
Absolutely. It's so important. I was telling you before we started that there was a woman here who was a community policing officer, just an ordinary beat cop, and she was so compassionate with the homeless people here. It's so important. And that sort of thing, there needs to be more emphasis on that. And as you write in the book, Practical Wisdom, and I should do a little station ID, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking tonight with Dr. Barry Schwartz, co-author of a much-needed book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. You talk about loading people down with rules. So there are wise people out there. They know what they're doing. And this is in a section, I have to quote this because I love it, wisdom is moral jazz. And I'd like you to explain that through the prism of the wildland firefighters and, you know, what messed them up in terms of being given a bunch of rules.
Right. So, well, first, what we mean when we say that wisdom is moral jazz is that jazz music, most jazz music, there are notes on the page, right? There are charts. There is a formal composition. But what makes jazz is not the notes on the page. It's the way that the musicians dance around the notes, improvise around the notes, and they do it differently every time. And our view is that rules are like notes on the page. If we don't have notes on the page, you don't have anything. But if you do have notes on the page, that's the beginning of the conversation, not the end. And so a skilled jazz musician dances around the notes. A skilled doctor, a skilled lawyer, and a skilled teacher dance around the rules, knowing when to make exceptions, how to make exceptions, and why to make exceptions. And we describe this case of the firefighters, wildland firefighters, where they used to have four or five rules of thumb about how to proceed when a fire was raging out of control, and most of what they did was left to their judgment. So this was sort of like the formal composition in a jazz piece, four or five rules of thumb. And then, as naive firefighters, they didn't know how to use their judgment, but they were working with experienced firefighters, and slowly they learned how to use their judgment. And they became very skilled at getting fires controlled and preventing themselves from becoming casualties. And what happened over the years is, with the best of intentions, those four or five rules of thumb became 20, 50, 75, 100 different rules that they were meant to follow. Each new rule was meant to protect them, but it had the opposite effect, because what you've now got is a generation of firefighters who've never had the opportunity or the occasion to develop their judgment. They're just trying to figure out which rule applies in this situation and then follow it. And the result was less successful fighting and controlling of fires and higher rates of casualty, despite the fact that the only reason the rules were put there was to make firefighting more effective and safer. And we have another analogous example of the judgment it takes to be a battlefield commander in the military. The higher ups, the top brass, are concerned that military field commanders are not as good at leading troops as they used to be, and they commissioned a study to figure out why. And what the guy who did the study concluded is that the way most field commanders learn how to be wise in leading troops is in the course of training new recruits, where, like the wildland firefighters, they have a short list of objectives, and how they meet those objectives is left to them. So they're improvising all the time. There's a lot of trial and error. And over time, they develop terrific judgment about how to lead and manage men and women. And that's been replaced over the years. Those half dozen of objectives have been replaced by something like 250 objectives. And now they're just like cooks following a recipe. And the result is that when they're in a situation that there aren't any rules for, they have nothing to fall back on.
And it's just so crazy. You know, there's just such a lack of trust, and it's just mushroomed. And right out of college, I worked as a producer at a big ad agency, and I learned basically that my job was to find the greatest possible director I could for the money and to get everybody out of the way so they could do their job, because I hired people, or got the client to hire people who knew what they were doing. And it seems if you know, hire people who are great, that would be really smart. But instead, why do these people, these companies and military, why is everyone hobbling the people they have working for them?
I wish I knew the answer to that. You know, there's a little bit of, I think it's self-protective and self-serving by management. The more you hire people who know how to do their jobs, the less you're needed as a manager.
Of course.
I think people love, really, really like to be able to exert control over the people they manage, and telling people to figure out on their own the best way to do things means giving up some control. I think people are terrified of mistakes, and somehow they think that if they run a tight enough ship and look over people's shoulders carefully enough, they'll prevent mistakes from happening. And even if you succeed in preventing mistakes from happening, what you end up getting is mediocrity. No catastrophes, but nothing great. And I think this is a terrible way to manage people. It's a terrible way to run companies. I've had a little bit of experience interacting with the folks at Google, and as near as I can tell, this is not the way Google operates. And I think that there's something to be learned from that. I think hiring great people, and great meaning not only that they're technically skilled, but also that they have the telos, that their goal is your goal. They want to do great things, and they have the skill to do great things, and then you just get the hell out of their way.
How do you encourage that as a corporate culture? Do you know how that would be done, or is that something you'd like to think about?
I think about it a lot. I think there's enormous pressure, especially in publicly held companies, to produce appropriate margins, appropriate returns on investment, quarter by quarter, month by month, and week by week. And that makes everybody extremely risk averse, extremely cautious. So that's not the environment in which you will see people encouraging the folks who work for them to do great things on their own. I think it's quite interesting that when Google went public, they did it in a way that no company ever had before, which was you could buy shares, but you had nothing, you had no power to tell the company what to do. So these were basically non-voting shares. Yeah, you can get rich with the rest of us, but if you think you're going to tell us how to run our company, don't buy the stock. And that was unheard of, and it's become commonplace among the dot-com entrepreneurs that, you know, when they go public, they issue a class of shares where they retain essentially complete control over what the company does and how it does it. So that's rare. Mostly public companies feel beholden to their shareholders, and that makes the people who run them extremely careful about how they manage their workforce, and it makes their time horizons extremely short, which is terrible.
And one thing that's really unfortunate about this, you write in your book Practical Wisdom that experience and failing and learning from failures is so important to becoming wise, yet these companies, they don't accept any sort of failure.
That's right. That's right. Now, look, you can't teach people how to become cardiac surgeons by letting them kill patients. So failure is not an option in all circumstances, but it is certainly an option in a lot of them. And people learn a lot more from their mistakes than from pretty much anything else. So what you want to do is create, in effect, you know, you create a safe environment where the mistakes won't be catastrophic. The way we get our kids to learn how to swim is we basically push them, nudge them just a little bit out of their comfort zone, but with our, you know, ready to just put our arms around them if anything goes wrong. So, you know, you're obviously not going to just throw your kid in the water and say, well, sink or swim. But there are ways to create a safe environment for a little bit of risk-taking and a little bit of experimentation, and you are the safety net. And that's the kind of environment we need to try to create when we're trying to teach people how to be wise practitioners of whatever it is they're practicing. You're right. And if people don't get to take chances and fail and learn from failures, it's hard to see how they'll ever get any wiser. You know, there's an old saying, I think Will Rogers may have said it, there are people who've had 30 years of experience and there are people who've had the same experience for 30 years. We want the first kind of people, not the second kind of people.
Right. Actually, I thought you were going to quoted him. You said this isn't the exact quote, but that the way you learn good judgment is through experience, and most of that experience is bad judgment.
Yes. I know he said that, and we quote that. I don't know who said this other thing about 30 years of experience versus the same experience for 30 years. But I also want to point out, it's not just that we don't enable people to be wise. If we have them subject them to working conditions where they're following scripts, potentially wise people will leave the job. They'll do something else. They are not in the job to follow scripts. They are in the job to exert a certain amount of control, autonomy, and discretion in order to achieve the goals of the activity, whatever those may be. So you drive good teachers out of teaching. Lawyers hate being lawyers. Doctors hate the way they have to practice medicine. Teachers are quitting the profession after a very short time in the profession. So we've created environments where people can't get any satisfaction out of the work that they do. Now, no one's quitting anything these days because of the economy is so bad, but that, you know, 5 years ago that wasn't true, and presumably 5 years from now, once again, when the economy has picked up, we will end up losing our most talented and inspiring people because they're forced to work in an environment that doesn't allow them to display either their talent or their inspiration.
And you write, too, at the end of the book about wisdom and happiness, that what a major thing it is to be engaged in our work and how important that is to feeling satisfied, to having meaning in your life.
Well, the literature on happiness, of which there has been an enormous amount in the last decade or so, suggests that the two most important determinants of well-being are the quality of our relationships with other people and the quality of our relationship with our work. Do we get meaning and satisfaction out of our work? Do we have close, sustaining, nourishing relations with other people? What we suggest at the end of the book is that you can't have meaningful work and you can't have nourishing, sustaining relationships with other people unless you're wise. Wisdom is required to do work that's meaningful in a way that's satisfying and to sustain close relations to others. And what's good about that is it means that if we encouraged people to behave wisely in the workplace, it would become self-reinforcing because the more wisely they behaved, they would discover the better their lives went.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
And once that's true, you know, it's going to make them want to cultivate their wise judgment even more because there's an enormous payoff for them in being able to do these things wisely. They feel better about themselves every day when they get out of bed.
Yeah, and you really showed that with the story of Luke, the guy who cleaned the hospital room. And I think that people need to be encouraged to do that too, not just to do work that you find meaningful, but if you're a bus driver or if you're a custodian, to actually make your work meaningful, and you can do that. And I did a show early on in which I talked about a book, a little business book called The Fred Factor, and the author actually named his book after the most amazing mailman who went way above and beyond what being a mailman is supposed to be. The UPS, he was a United States Postal Service mailman, but he saw that the UPS had delivered a package that belonged to him to the neighbors, so he delivered the package from down the block to his doorway. The guy was away. He sort of hid the package. He left him a note. He did all this stuff. And this is the way, you know, because as you know and I know from the happiness research, that doing kind acts for others is a major way to get happier. And so these people who are making their work meaningful by helping others, that really increases their personal well-being.
Absolutely, and that's the reason why this colleague of mine, Amy Rosnewski, studied the hospital janitors, because it's just not true that any work has the equal potential with any other work to make us feel valuable and valued and to give our work meaning. It's a challenge in some jobs, but it is true that there are an awful lot of jobs that on the surface look like they offer no possibility for anything other than a paycheck, where if you really invest yourself in the jobs, there are these other interpersonal rewards that you won't have anticipated. But that's only true as long as the people who supervise you allow you to do those jobs well. If there was a supervisor standing over Luke and insisting that he be productive, then he wouldn't have been able to clean that kid's room twice. If there was a supervisor standing over his colleague saying, listen, now's the time to clean the visitor's lounge, she wouldn't have been able to let the exhausted family members take their nap. So you need to have an environment in which people are actually allowed to do the job the way they think it should be done. And I worry that as the financial pressure on institutions grows, there will be more and more sort of speeding people up, reducing the workforce and making heavier demands on the people who remain, so that all that people have time for is the checklist that is their official formal job description. And this will not only rob us of an enormous gift that these people can provide, but it will rob them of the opportunity to feel like their work is meaningful.
And actually, I think it's actually fiscally unsound for the businesses, because the hospital where Luke worked, I mean, this is a hospital, and the hospital, my friend was at Cedars-Sinai. I passed there. I have this warm glow, even though my friend died in that hospital. You know, I feel good about that business.
It's true. It's very short-sighted. People do notice. They care a lot. It's very short-sighted. Unfortunately, managers tend to be very short-sighted. This isn't inevitable, but it's the way things currently are.
And it's not easy. You know, I have an employee. I have a woman who works for me part-time editing my column. And, you know, I have a strong personality, and I had to train myself to let go a little, because she's wise and I trust her and I need to trust her. And that thing where you need to just trust your employees and let go a little, if you hire good people to begin with, they generally impress the hell out of you.
Yeah. But it does take trust. Trust of not only of the your employee's ability, but also of her intentions.
Yeah.
You know, she wants what you want, and you know, that's it's a big step to be willing to invest that kind of trust in other people. But I think it's essential, and we pay a huge price, an emotional price, a psychological price, and a financial price, in thinking that if we set up the right rules, then we don't need to trust anymore.
Well,
that's simply false.
And in fact, I think people are lazy. They're lazy about, for example, hiring judiciously. And I had to learn how to do this, what kind of person to hire, what to look for, and to admit your mistakes. You talk about that, how people don't like to admit their mistakes.
Yeah.
But that's how you learn. That's how you benefit from your experience, as opposed to just experiencing it, like you said, from Will Rogers over for 30 years.
No, it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And I have enormous respect for people who are willing to be wrong, especially people who are willing to be wrong in public. You see this among academics, you know, researchers, where there's sort of, I think the general attitude is there's nothing worse than being wrong. And the result is that people tend to be extremely safe. Each study they do, each paper they publish is a slight extension of what they already know. So they'll never be wrong, and they'll never change anything. The bold thinkers will often be wrong, and when they are, they will be publicly wrong. But instead of being shamed by it, they regard it, I think, as this is basically how real progress gets made. But it takes courage to fail in public.
So we're almost out of time. I want to ask you, because I know this is important to people who have kids, can we model wisdom for kids and have them pick up on it, or does it have to be something they live, you know, that they experience, go through all the trial and error on and failure?
Well, I think that the answer is both of those things. The attending physician who's training the interns and the residents is both trying to enable them to have experiences and learn from failure, but make sure that the failures are not catastrophic, and modeling what it means to do the job well. And I think that parents similarly have to do both of those things. We say this about teachers. Teachers are always teaching. whatever they do every minute of the day, and the kids are more attentive to what they're doing when they're not doing a formal lesson than they are when they are doing a formal lesson. So unless you appreciate that you're always on stage as a teacher or as a parent, your kids will learn things from observing how you act that may be the exact opposite of what you're trying to teach them explicitly. So it takes a lot to be a good parent. You sort of have to be the kind of person that you want your kids to be.
So you have to be empathetic in order to teach them basically the foundation that they need practical wisdom.
You know, there are people who manage to pull it off even though they themselves do not live exemplary lives. But for the most part, it's a whole lot easier if you embody what you're trying to teach than if you don't.
So do you have a final thought about what people can do to be practically wise? If there's one thing that you could tell people, what would it be?
Listen. Open your ears. Be courageous enough to acknowledge that what you hear from other people might change you. Be willing to take risks. Be willing to make mistakes.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. We've just had a wonderful hour with Dr. Barry Schwartz, co-author of Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing, a book I really recommend because it totally desnobifies wisdom. None of that Plato snotty stuff that it can't be for anybody but the elite. You can use wisdom in your job, personal life, and relationships to be much happier and have a better life. So, Barry, thank you so much. This was fantastic.
My pleasure, Amy. Thank you.
And thanks, everybody. Join us next week. Another exciting show.
Big news. The news.